So that's the pointer, the small, the red. I have a hard time seeing it, that's why. But if you point it here.
I don't even think anybody's going to see it. That's okay. Can you see? Can we see a pointer here? Normally you can put a pointer on here. There's a pointer ability on this thing, if we can get it up. Can you get it off the slide? No, that's not what I meant. Where it's not on presentation mode here. I understand, but there's usually a pointer, a live pointer, if you don't have this up. If you're mirroring that, there's a pointer down there. You don't know how to do that. Okay, fair enough. Okay, fair enough. I think we're going to go ahead and get started. I'm already late. So I guess I should go ahead and introduce myself. We're running already a little late. Sorry. I'm as ready as I'm going to be.
We're only a couple minutes late. For those of you who have been here before, you all know Charlie Chang. She is a neurocritical care doctor. I think it's really important for emergency docs to have lots of different specialties because that's our life. And that's one of the proud things I have about this conference is we have all sorts of different doctors coming and helping us get to be better in what we do. So Charlie's going to talk about strokes today, something you see every single shift.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me again to speak this time about a little bit about different strokes affect different folks. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the changes in stroke, but of course the updates in management, which is what you're interested in. My disclosures, none are financial, but I do write for the ABIM critical care and the ABPN neurocritical care exams, and I have to say that I'm not going to show any of the answers there. So one thing to be aware of, that stroke still is the second leading cause of death in the world, and that has dropped due to some of the things we're going to be talking about to the fifth leading cause. It previously was the third leading cause in the U.S. So it has gone up from 720,000 when it was per year of recurring to new strokes. It used to be several years ago. Now it's up to 795. So though we have fewer deaths from it, we still have a lot of strokes too. Most of them are ischemic strokes, so that's what we're going to focus on today, the 87% versus 10% the ICH and 3%, and that probably has dropped in part because of blood pressure management, that we have less ICH. So just to be aware, decades ago when I used to lecture about this, men were more likely to have strokes, but if you see from this slide where a red or female and men are in the blue, that actually women in the younger ages and at the older ages lead by increased prevalence over men, except for the ages between 60 to 79. And that the age-adjusted death rates by sex and race ethnicity is in part due to some of the discrepancies that we know about in healthcare. But if you look at non-Hispanic white, that first bar set of bars, it's no different between males and females, but different in black, much higher in the males, as well as a higher death rate. And then you see the Asian Pacific Islanders, and then I don't have a pointer that you folks can see very well, but you can see the North American Indian also quite high, and then Hispanic there, but the black population is more at risk for death. So just to be aware, and you folks I know come from different parts of the country, I just put this up as a quick slide to know where the stroke centers are when you look at some of the CMS data, the Census Bureau, that in those hotter red areas, the rural areas, are where we have higher proportions of the elderly, Native American, uninsured people, and lower medium income, and they are more distant from stroke centers. So we have to be aware of those people that are less access to care. So what we're going to be focusing on, we have the 218 guidelines for early management, which are quite comprehensive, but because of some of the changes, it's pretty unheard of, but they actually updated it just the following year in 2019. So we're going to focus on some of that. Some of the things that you probably are aware of is that there's a lot of emphasis now on pre-hospital management procedures, that we want to have the pre-hospital providers identifying people who might be ineligible for IV thrombolysis, but now might have a large vessel occlusion that might be a candidate for thrombectomy. So those are patients you have to identify and get out to a place that has that capability. So get those patients with rapid transport to the closest center. So it may not be the comprehensive stroke center that's maybe 2 hours away, but the thrombectomy capable center, that might be a half hour away. So, and if the thrombectomy center can't manage that patient, they will move the patient forward, but get them to the fastest place that has thrombectomy capable. And we'll talk about that in a minute. So I just wanted to show, and this is mostly for your handout because you're not going to be able to go through all of these different severity scales, and you may be already aware of what your EMS is using. There's things that are the three-item stroke scale, the LAMS or the Los Angeles, and this is a little too small to see, but there's also the RACE scale, but those require the pre-hospital providers to look for agnosia and aphasia. Most are using the CSTAT or the Cincinnati Pre-Hospital Severity Scale that's just looking at gaze, disorders of consciousness, and see if they're weak or not. So that's usually the fastest way to do this. So the new recommendations from the 2019 to be aware of is that it's really emphasized that you should use your telemedicine capability if you don't have on-site stroke expertise. There's good data that shows telestroke, teleradiology can make appropriate decisions for you, and even telephone conversations can be helpful. Now, we have used, it's not HIPAA compliant, but sometimes using a smartphone to even look at the images, sometimes from a remote hospital. I've been in that situation where I'm getting calls. So wake-up stroke we are going to talk about because it has opened the window, and so I'm going to emphasize a little bit of that, of having you think about if you have the ability to look at the MRI, look at a DWI and flare sequence to open that window to give that wake-up stroke a possibility, because we used to never be able to give those patients thrombolysis. And again, as I mentioned, if there is suspected thrombectomy patient, if you have the capability, getting a CT angio of both the head and the brain can help the people plan ahead if you have a reasonable scan, not waiting for the serum creatinine. So that's something new, and you folks I know are probably quite aware that no one's waiting for serum creatinine anymore for a contrasted scan if it's life-threatening or disability-threatening, and then rapid transport, as we talked about. And we'll talk about the mechanical thrombectomy window that's open. And one thing just to be aware of, carotid stenosis, back in the day being in medical school, we used to think you had to wait months, but now they're saying if you have a lesion that's at risk, you can revascularize that, have a good vascular surgeon do this, open it up as soon as 48 hours to 7 days within the index event to prevent another stroke. So some of the things when you're approaching the patient, is that ischemic stroke? Is this patient a thrombolysis candidate? So you need to get your time of last known normal is what the buzzwords that we're asking both the pre-hospital providers as well as the you in the emergency department, looking at other reperfusion strategies, and then more in the critical care world or knowing the etiology to prevent secondary events or extension, watching for edema, and then preventing complications. So this is what we're thinking of, is that with the occlusion, if we revascularize, typically we know that if there's already infarcted tissue and you open that up, we're going to have a blood-brain barrier that's broken down and more edema and hemorrhage. So that's why it's important to try and get this right as far as time goes. And we know that every minute, even though we have that time window, every minute that patient is losing almost 2 million brain cells a minute. So as you can see from the odds ratio on the y-axis, that favorable outcome goes down, even though that time window is still open. As time goes on, losing those minutes is going to make it less likely that your patient's going to have a good outcome. So every minute counts. So sometimes I'm calling the lab. Well, now we're not needing the laboratory, but we're calling the CT and trying to get the patient there because every minute counts. So this is mostly, again, for your handout. I'm not going to go through all of this, but just to be aware from some of us that are older that the package insert used to use all the NIH study criteria, which was quite comprehensive, getting a bunch of labs, doing all these other things. If you look at the list now in the package insert, it's basically if you have hemorrhage or bleeding that's recent, those are really the contraindications to giving TPA in these patients, but it's not all the other things if you think that patient's going to bleed. And again, this will be available to you to look at or in the package insert. They clarified in 2019 the guidelines that we still, except for the things that I'm going to talk to you about the wake-up stroke, but the 4.5-hour window, the 3 to 4.5-hour window really was for the thinking that if they looked at the subsets, if you were over 80, you were more likely to have a bad outcome if you got it within this time window. If you had NIH stroke scale, it was really terrible. So 0 being normal, greater than 25, those patients didn't do so well. If they had both stroke and diabetes, they tended not to do well if they were obviously anticoagulated or if they already had a very large stroke. Those patients, you wouldn't potentially go to this 3 to 4.5 hour window. So those are what the guidelines say. And for laboratories, now it's changed to just get a point-of-care glucose. That's really the only laboratory, unless you know that that patient's on an anticoagulant or you have a suspicion that their platelet count might be down. We don't delay anything for doing a cardiac workup and chest x-ray only if there's something that you're worried about specifically, but you shouldn't be delaying your IV tPA. You could be getting a chest x-ray, but don't delay anything. So the key here is that people used to say, well, they're getting a little bit better, so maybe I should wait and monitor them for further improvement. What they're showing is that there can be harm. So you do not wait to see if that patient is getting better, because often if they get better, they will get worse again. So if you think that patient looks bad, go ahead and give them the tPA. Now, I mentioned the wake-up stroke. It happens more often than we'd like. So the time window has excluded these patients, as we talked about. The incidence can be anywhere from 15 to 25, and if you look at these studies, it's maybe even higher, depending if you're in France or in your Ohio. It could be, you know, up to 39% where people are coming in with these wake-up strokes, and we used to say, sorry, there's nothing to do. So they did a really nice study called the wake-up. Wake-up investigators did this study and said, well, let's take patients with unknown time of onset, and we can treat them within 4.5 hours of either when they woke up or within time. You don't want to wait when you know for sure it's beyond the 6 hours. And they got an MRI, and they looked to see on MRI, and I'll show you some pictures, if there was an area of restricted diffusion, so you're looking at the DWI, if there's an abnormality there, but the flare sequence, so flare is fluid attenuated, where you're looking for edema in that area, if that were negative, those patients were given tPA, and you can see that those patients that got that in the top, the Alta place, I'm just showing the white is the modified Rankine scale. So as people looking at disability, 0 is normal, 6 is dead. So they were moving people from the if you were in placebo versus getting tPA, you can see that you made more people normal, moved more people into one where they had slight disability but still were able to carry on everything normally, and 2 still felt to be able to do all your ADLs. So these were still favorable if you got tPA. The symptomatic hemorrhage went from 0.4 to 2%, but was not statistically significant. So these are the pictures. So the upper one where there's a negative flare. So if you look at the DWI, where on the left side you see that bright area, so that's restricted diffusion, bioenergetic failure, usually area we're thinking is already infarcted. But on the flare sequence, you can see that it's not bright. So below that one, the next slide, next below there, you see that there is a positive DWI in that right side, the basal ganglia. And just if you look very subtly on the flare, I think I convince you see a sign there. If you give that patient IV tPA, that second patient will bleed, but the first one probably will not, is what the data shows. Another is showing that you may see on that flare sequence here on this other patient, those white matter changes that we see, the DWI, but the DWI pattern in that full left MCA is not seen on the flare, so that patient would be a candidate because those changes look chronic on the flare. So these patients with wake-up stroke, remember to think about getting an MRI if they're within that 4.5 hours of when they got to you or woke up. So they got to you within an hour, and they said, well, Grandma was, I didn't see her since last night, but you would get an MRI and potentially, hopefully, use tPA. Now, some of the guidelines did talk about mild strokes. People say, well, what do you do if a patient has very mild strokes? I'm not going to go through all these little tiny type, but just I summarized it here. If it's very mild, so an NIH stroke scale 0 to 5, and it's non-disabling, so say they have a teeny tiny little labial flattening that might grade on the NIH as a 1, and a little bit of numbness, which also grades, those you wouldn't give tPA. But if it's mild but disabling, so they can't speak, they can't swallow, those patients you would give tPA. So you can go into more of the details, but they did address mild strokes, which I know affects you folks in the emergency department. Just remember that if they bleed when you've given tPA, And it's a common sense thing. You're going to stop the TPA. You're going to get some laboratories, a CBC, COAGs, a fibrinogen level, get a type and cross, get a head CT to see if they've bled. Typically, even if you call the neurosurgeon, they're not going to do anything. The studies had shown that you call the neurosurgeon, they typically don't do well anyhow, and they don't go to surgery. But we will give cryoprecipitate if the fibrinogen is low. You might think about using tryoxamic acid, and these are in the guidelines. And like I said, get into neurosurgery, maybe hematology consult, and just support the patient. So we're going to come out of TPA right now, the IV thrombolysis, and talk about thrombectomy. So the upper two, the Mercy device was a corkscrew device, some of the old generation. You won't see that much anymore. It was kind of pulling it out. The tips used to break. And the penumbra was a suction aspiration catheter. The guidelines now say the stent retriever. So if you see this solitaire Trevo, is that the stent goes in, pushes the clot with the tines up against the wall, and then pulls it out. And they've shown that it's faster when you're using stent retrievers. So I'm sure your interventionalists know that they should be using stent retrievers, but it's sometimes helpful to know what they're using. And this is just a picture of showing the full-on the MCA cutoff there and then reperfusion. So I talked already about the modified Rankin scale, and this is just to remind you again, when you're looking at studies, remember that no disability is zero, no symptoms. You really want to be at a level at least two of slight disability when you're looking at studies, and for stroke reasons, when you start getting into three, it's not as felt to be as favorable, so that's important to realize. One of the things, and how many of you, who work in the emergency department, have heard aspect score? Okay, good. So aspect score, a lot of times the neurologist is going to ask you that. And this is the Alberta Stroke Program early CT scan. And what it was is to try and figure out and have a standardized way of seeing what's already infarcted. I told you that if you had an area that was one-third the distribution of the vessel and you had a stroke, you wouldn't want to give that patient thrombolysis. So this is sort of looks complicated, and if you want to pull it up just on Google, and you're in the middle of the emergency department, but basically it's grading on a scale of 10. You're looking at areas of the middle cerebral artery, so the frontal area, the temporal lobe, and M1, 2, and 3, the insula and eye, the L is the lenticular nuclei, and then higher up. 10 is normal. That means everything looks great. So, but in someone like this, so you can see that they have a dense MCA sign there on the right side, and you can see very subtly that there's that hypodensity. So that's an area that's already infarcted. So that's graded in the M2, M3, as far as the aspect score. So that would bring you down from 10 to 8. Those patients we'll talk about, you would still potentially think about thrombectomy. The reason why is that they've done studies showing that if your aspect score is less or equal to 7, those patients are less likely to do well if you try and revascularize, and they're more likely to have hemorrhage. So that's why people are going to ask, what's the aspect score? So you can see for aspect score of 10 on the left-hand side, white being independent, that Rankin score of 0 to 2, you can see that those patients tend to do well. And as the aspects goes down, and you can see where that 7, where you now have a lot of people in the dependent area. So because you have the 14-fold increased odds of symptomatic hemorrhage, you don't want to do harm. So important to kind of look at this. Sometimes we toggle the CT scan so we can see these areas of infarct. This one's not subtle. You can see the entire MCA's out. So you'd go from a 10 being normal to every area except that tiny little caudate is still there. So that would be down to an aspect score of 1. So you obviously wouldn't think about even calling the interventionalist for this patient. This is kind of a complicated slide, but I think it's important to just realize that when you're looking at thrombectomy patients, if you look at the Mr. Clean trial, for example, on the top, that the time window, so if looking at that second, and I apologize, I don't have a good pointer on this, but in that third column in the time window, these studies for thrombectomy went anywhere from this 4.5 hours to out to 12 hours in the escape. Medium age was in the next columns like around 65 to 70s. The IV TPA, some of the trials like the Extend IA and the Swift Prime required getting IV TPA. So this is important for you to know that even if you think the patient's a thrombectomy patient, still give TPA if they're a candidate. Other studies were more variable, 68, 89%. And the onset to actually puncture time was usually out into the 200-something minutes. The stent retriever, you can see, for the most part, this is why they're using the stent retrievers, 80 to 95%. And the 90-day modified Rankin scale, this is why we're doing it in that orange column there, is that you go from 19% being independent to 32%. The next one's 29 to 53, 40 to 71, 35 to 60, and 28 to 43. So we're doing better for our patients. Less in that whole column, and the next is non-significant hemorrhage. So we really want to get these patients, the appropriate patients, to thrombectomy. More recent studies show that even if you go 1 to 2 years out, that if you look at that plot again, that you are keeping more people that had the intervention on the upper part column in that good modified Rankin scale. So you're doing well for your patient, even years out. This is what the interventionalists use. These are 2015, but they still stand, is that IVTPA should be given even if you're thinking about thrombectomy. So don't stop checking the box while someone's trying to get the patient either through to the thrombectomy site or to calling your interventionalist. They should be getting a stent retriever, as we talked about. And we talked about pre-stroke. The interventionalist is going to want to know if the patient's very disabled. Was their modified Rankin scale really terrible before? Is the occlusion close enough they can get at? So proximal MCA, ICA, sometimes they can go a little distally to the M2, but usually they want something that's really close to where they can get at. Studies were done in the older, obviously greater than 18, not the little kids. And then NIH stroke scale looks significant because they don't want to be causing problems and making your NIH stroke scale potentially worse. And then, as we talked about, the aspect score needs to be greater than 6. So if they're in consideration for mechanical thrombectomy, and I think I've said this, is that you don't observe them and wait to see if the IVTPA is working. You should be getting everything. If they happen to totally recannulate and everything's normal, the interventionist might still squirt them and see if there's something that's still there, but don't not keep going. And then for emergency imaging, thinking about, as I talked about earlier, get the CTA. Or in the case of maybe wake up, you get an MRI and an MRA in those patients. And they do consider patients with the more distal findings, especially the vertebral basilar, the posterior circulation, because as you know, the brainstem is high real estate, and they'll go after that usually 24 hours out. So things that we're doing, time of onset, thinking about whether you can give thrombolysis, get that glucose, and only if you need to get labs. And then the imaging, if it's acute, the CT scan, the CTA of the head and neck if you think it's a proximal occlusion, if it's one of those patients that has all those symptoms at those pre-hospital scale. And then I usually tell the emergency room, get some fluid running. If they get dye, you want that anyhow, but it also just kind of helps things flow. So get some IV. Oftentimes patients are dry, so that helps. So opening the window has been really important beyond the time window. And so this is looking at tissue areas. So I've already talked to you about the DWI. The ADC map, the apparent diffusion coefficient, kind of confirms the DWI is acute. Sometimes the DWI may have a shine through of an old infarct, and in that case, the ADC will also be bright. But when you see bright and dark, we know it's acute. And then we look at the perfusion-weighted imaging, and this is really key. How many in your hospital have the ability to do perfusion? Good. So either the rapid, usually it's the rapid software. So the studies that Albers had done is that it also helps us know that if you have an area, some malignant profile on the DWI, large stroke, PWI is huge as well, but the area that's already dead by DWI is the area of perfusion weighted. Those patients don't do well. They're more likely if you try and do something to them, like thrombectomy, they're going to end up dying anyhow and getting hemorrhage. So it's helpful if you see a large match like this. We would call this a malignant matching profile. What you want to see is this, where there's a huge mismatch. So their convention is that if you see the colored area where that's green, that green area is an area at risk where the perfusion is down. And the convention would be that pink on the left-hand side, if that was dead, and matching like we saw on the other one, that would be bright pink. So when you see this huge mismatch, and this is from the Dawn trial, and so the Dawn and Diffuse I'll talk about, that helped us open the window. If you revascularize that person, pull that clot out, they're going to do well. So this is, they took, and I don't want to go into all the technical, but they took the cerebral blood flow, which is the area that we're thinking is dead, versus the mean time to transient or the Tmax, the time the flow gets in there where the perfusion is down, and put it in this mismatch software. So that if you look at the green again, that's area that's at risk with that little pink area, huge mismatch, and they actually calculate it's kind of tiny there, 105 cc's that are mismatched, and the mismatch ratio is 9.1. These are perfect candidates for a thrombectomy. If you open that up, that patient's probably going to do well. Here's another area. And so this is patient one, has a large area of mismatch. And you can see that the MCA, there's a big space there, the little clot came out, it opened things up. And that patient initially was unable to look to the left or see, had a homonymous hemianopsia and the left hemiplegia. And after thrombectomy, was normal and went home. So these patients do quite well. It's helpful to identify these. This is patient two, and you can see big mismatch difference as well. Had this little blur come out and had a smaller stroke there, but still did well. And this is patient three. Again, large area of mismatch, infinite mismatch, because there's no pink there at all. So these are the ones that your interventionists love. They get into there. And this patient did have still a little bit of an infarct, probably was a time element, but certainly wasn't as big as the entire MCA, so they can limit that stroke. Now, in this case, and this is where it's really helpful, and I know when I was practicing here in Hawaii, I've since moved, but we would decide who would be flown to the main island to be treated using the software, because if you see this where the area of perfusion lack in the green matches that large area of stroke, those are the ones you probably, this guy is aphasic, it's left-sided, he's hemiplegic, and where you really want to have a discussion with the family about letting him stay in his community so family can be with him, because nothing at the stroke center besides good care that they could provide at any other, hopefully other hospital that they're at, would be able to take care of this patient. They can stay with their family. Again, this brain scan will show the stroke mismatch, and it helps that this shows that that patient ended up having that big infarct, and it allows us to stay where have that patient stay where they should. So in your handout, if you're interested and you have this probably in your hospital that has interventionalists, they use different criteria, the DON or the DIFFUSE, and those are the ones, the studies that use this mismatch criteria. So again, they were older than 18, they had a significant NIH in both the studies, one was greater than 6, one greater than 10. They weren't horribly premorbid, disabled with the modified Rankin scale, and then the aspects, as we talked about, one used the aspects, others just used the MCA territory, which could have been the aspects, and then was able to get, the DON went out to 24, the DIFFUSE trial went out to 16, and used different core numbers, I'm not going to get into that, different mismatch ratios, but those are the patients that we can use imaging to open the window, so we're not just using time alone. This is showing, again, where in the DON study, where the modified Rankin scale went up from a 4% with a 0, modified Rankin scale 0, from 4% to 9%, and then you can see that just incrementally that the patients that you moved into the modified Rankin scale 1 or 2 was significant. So with thrombectomy, with the right patient, you don't need to treat 13 to 1, which you do with TPA. It's 2 to 1 to make a significant difference in lowering disability. And it's the same for the DIFFUSE trial. I'm not going to go through all of this, but the number needed to treat was 2. So really important to be able to look at these patients and potentially treat them. And this is just, I'm not going to go through this slide, it's in your handout, but it says what we had talked about a minute. So these two trials had opened up the window for us. Now, some of you, and who's using Tenecteplase for your strokes? So some people are, good. So Tenecteplase is an option, especially good for transport. There's been increasing number of studies about this. It is a genetically modified variant of Alteplase or TPA. It has a greater fibrin specificity, so the hope was less risk for bleeding. It's faster onset of action, longer half-life, and the best part, you don't have to do an infusion after that single bolus injection. So there's a timeless trial that's going on looking at a different window and trying to use this, but I can tell you that in some places that already, say in New Zealand, that they have switched from Tenecteplase for stroke thrombolysis, and they published this. It's just there for you to see that they've gone, the dose is 0.25 milligrams per kilo for a max of 25, which is lower than the MI dose of the 0.5 that you might be using. But they moved more patients into having good modified Rankine scale, if you can see that upper in the right-hand corner, 3-month modified Rankine scale of 0 to 2 with no significant increase in the hemorrhage or death. So they're very happy with having switched, and I know some hospitals have done that. And especially when you're transporting a patient, the old drip and ship, it's not dripping, it's inject and ship. So that might be very helpful and something to think about. Other things, just that you're standing at the bedside and you're asking your nurse to manage the patient, is just airway support. As you know, I'm really talking about O2 sats greater than 94, and if they're satting fine, don't give them extra oxygen. It hasn't been quite as harmful as we're talking about with MIs of giving too much supplemental, but it's felt that you shouldn't be over-oxygenating them. So just because some of these patients are coming into the ED and you're trying to figure out, you know, are they on the right treatment? I just want to mention a few things that are more in management of a stroke, the chronic, even chronic stroke patients. But if they're on clopidogrel, just remember they shouldn't be on a proton pump inhibitor. Clopidogrel needs to be changed. It's a prodrug that needs to be activated through the CYP and isoenzyme, so the PPIs will competitively inhibit. So if they need something for their stomach prophylaxis or whatever, they should be on an H2 and not a PPI. Also, just a reminder that if they've had a stroke, you shouldn't see them on prasugrel because they're more likely to have another stroke. So just two things that sometimes we still see. And then this is too much to go through, but I just wanted to, I summarized it, is that when you're talking about atrial fibrillation, what and when. So if you're using a DOAC, we used to only do it for paroxysmal or now even if it's chronic AFib, unless you're needing full anticoagulation for mitral stenosis or mechanical valve. If there's contraindications to anticoagulation, you now think about closure, and then for stroke that are high risk, wait 14 days, so that's a lot faster. Low risk, starting within 2 to 14 days, will anticoagulate. And if they have a TIA, we'll start immediately, and we don't use DOACs in renal disease. So dissection, just to mention, is that we can use antiplatelets or anticoagulants for 3 to 6 months. For medications, you just reminder that before TPA, the guidelines in the red is saying keeping the blood pressure less than 185 before thrombolysis. After thrombolysis, the guidelines go down to 180 for systolic and from 110 to 105. And there's the different agents that we use, labetalol, nifedipine, clavitipine. This is just saying different time windows, that time is brain. I'm not going to go through this, but as you know, we're trying to close that window shorter and shorter, even though we have the 60 minutes. Many are going for that 30-minute goal of door to needle, and there's certain marks that you should be meeting in within your emergency department. And finally, just a few things, and we're talking different strokes for different folks. They're talking about these new guidelines that came out this year. Target the diagnostic workup for your patient with the etiologic subtype rather than doing shotgun. We're targeting the individual for their modifying the risk factors. And for lifestyle, again, they're talking about Mediterranean diet, that now they'd like to recommend making sure the patient gets to programs for behavioral changes, not just advising them. And just remember that antithrombotics typically is indicated in nearly every stroke patient, but not necessarily like a combination of antiplatelets and anticoagulation because of the bleeding. Also remember that if you see patients on dual antiplatelets for stroke reasons, it shouldn't be a long-term, only short-term, because those patients bleed. It's usually indicated for someone who's coming in with a minor stroke, a high risk for TIA, severe symptomatic intracranial stenosis, but only for a short term. But of course, it's used for heart, but not for stroke. I'm almost done. We're monitoring for AFib. I already talked about carotid stenosis can be treated a lot sooner, and looking for intracranial stenosis when we find it. We don't do intervention on those patients. We treat them medically. Think about closure in patients, and then with some of the feeling is that if there's an uncertain source, people had just been bombing patients with anticoagulation, ticagrelor, there's no particular benefit that they've seen in just blindly treating patients. So move fast, last time seen normal when they were found, assess the history, their medications, and are they a thrombolytic candidate. Get that stat CT, think proximal vessel, get that stat CT, angio, MRA, don't delay the IV TPA, it's still important. use the criteria to evaluate for LVO, and then remember that thrombectomy now has opened that window, especially using the software that we talked about, this new technology. We're going to be tissue-based, no longer time-based, hopefully, and get that MRI, DWI, and flare to determine eligibility in those patients. So thank you very much.